go ahead and open up to Luke chapter 12, verses 13 down, but we're going to start, I'm going to push us a little further back first, but I want to say this, in your bulletin, you see that community groups, we've got two more weeks to sign up, so we have this Sunday and one more Sunday to sign up for community groups, and so there's a lot of work that's going to have to go into it. I have a stack this thick full of people. Plus, we have 30-something leaders that have been training throughout the summer, and so it's a lot of people to be compiling and putting together and reading through different things that you've said hobby-wise, things, people that you've mentioned, at least one person that you want to be in a community group with, or one couple. So I encourage you and challenge you again that this is a core. In our new members class that we are going through, one of the things Paul mentioned is about how important it is to have vision for a church, for a pastor. And that is something that is absolutely the vision of me, that I have for our church, is you do not get missional. You do not do the things God has called us to do until you get community right. So the goal is to get community right, and God will flow into all the other things that our church needs to be healthy. And so this is a big part of helping our church become the church God's called us to be. So again, if you have not entered into a group, or if you haven't signed up yet, please take this week or next week to sign up, because then it's going to be a lot of compiling and a lot of phone calls and a lot of work to get these things ready, because we are launching the second week in September. Plus, if you guys are wondering, I got asked a couple times today, when is Trevor starting? Trevor is starting in September. So he has already got a place to live, and him and his wife are getting rid of jobs and moving down and coming all in to be part of our church. So they will be starting in September around that time. So with that said, let me pray, and we're going to get into just some time of looking at God's Word. Let's pray. Father, I just thank you for your Word. I thank you for your presence. I know that this week there's a lot going on. The last 2 weeks, God, from people who are struggling and battling cancer to now deaths of what would be the hardest thing for any of us, to lose a child, God, for one of our core leaders in our church, God. There's a lot going on. And God, I know that what we need right now is your presence. What we need is your Word. God, I pray that, God, you would not only protect us, but God, let this be a time of challenge. Let this be a time of encouragement. Let this be a time of hope that as we get into your Word, God, that we would be inspired to be who you've called us to be, God. We need you, and I pray as we get in your Word, God, that you would bring freedom that your Word brings, God. We love you. Let me pray. Amen. Today we're going to talk about a parable called the Parable of the Rich Fool. I have a chair here. I may at some point come sit down, but I'm going to attempt to do this during my sermon. But turn back with me, if you're in chapter 12, turn back to verse 1 in chapter 12. I want to read a couple verses with you. This is the context before our parable. And as I was reading this parable and studying for this parable, the context really stood out to me. Verse 1 and verse 2, it says this: "In the meantime, when so many thousands of the people had gathered together, they were trampling one another. He began to say to his disciples first." So I want you to imagine Jesus is speaking primarily to his disciples, this 12 group of people. And you got this massive group, it says thousands of people literally trampling one another. Now, you got to imagine, they don't have microphones, they don't have the ability to teach like we do, and right now that if I was talking without a microphone, the reality is many of you could not hear me. You wouldn't be able to hear what I'm saying. Maybe you would hear me. I think I have a pretty good vocal box, but some people you wouldn't be able to hear. But the point is, if we're just several hundred people in here, thousands of people are gathering, trampling, trying to get close to Jesus. Now, I want to let you read, here's some of what Jesus says. In verse 4 through 7, I want to read a little bit of what Jesus talks about. In verse 4, it says this: "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have nothing more they can do. But I will warn you of whom to fear." This is a scary passage. "Fear him who, after he is killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 pennies, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Why, even the hair of your head are all numbered. Fear not. You are of more value than many sparrows. So we have some good comforting things that God's people, people are of value, tremendous value. But you also have this scary text where it talks about fear not what others can do to you, fear God. Fear the one who can place you and has the decision of placing you in hell or not in hell. So this is a bit of a scary teaching. This is not something that I don't think you would hear, and it would be something that would just go past your mind. It would be something that would stand out to you. And he's saying, no matter what, you know, what would you fear? What could you fear? Would you fear health? Could you fear diseases? Could you fear people wanting to murder you? In this time, surely they had in mind the Roman Empire that could come at any point and do whatever really it wanted to do to you. They just could because they had that kind of authority and they weren't trustworthy. They weren't good people in that sense. Surely there's lots of things, particularly Jewish people and Christians, could be worried about. And Jesus says, don't fear that. Don't fear them. Fear me. That's what Jesus says. Now, that's important for what I want to begin our parable with. Now, look with me at verse 13. So in the midst of thousands of people trampling one another, look what happens. Look what this man says. Verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus says this, verse 14. But he said to him, man, who made you a judge? Who made me a judge or arbitrary over you? And he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Now again, imagine thousands of people. This person must have been able or fit enough or some sort of way he was able to get to the front. So thousands of people. What would you ask? You have an opportunity, one question, one chance to ask one question to God, the Son of Man, the greatest figure. I think the only thing I could think of when I was thinking, how would this relate? Maybe the possibility of the Pope coming to La Porte, Texas. Now, we're not Catholic, but you certainly see the droves of people that would come to see this man, right? He's not just a general rabbi. He's not just some random pastor. This is the Pope. He's like a big deal for much of the world. It would be similar to that. And I say to you, you get one question. This man's got one opportunity. And what does he say? We know that in this time, this would be a thing that would be commonly done for rabbis, that they would talk and help people through matters such as this and dividing inheritance. You get one question, and this is what this man's thinking about. Jesus, of course, warns him and tells him that this is not important. And really, he's like, this is not the thing that you should be asking me. Of one question you could ask the Son of Man, you ask about money. You ask God to help you get money. And certainly, I think what Jesus is saying is there are so many more important things you could have asked. What would you ask? What would you ask? I think this is a very good example of a heart being focused on things that are not important. Jesus has the perspective of eternity. He just taught about fear the man, the person, the God that could throw you into hell for eternity. That's what you should be worried about. And what does he ask? About finances, money. Certainly this is a critique. Certainly this is a warning. And Jesus says you should be cared. There's much more important things than possessions. And he warns them. And we're going to get into that text and go real deep, but I wanted to point you at the context. I wanted you to see maybe an imagery of why this was seriously a bad question. In the midst of anything he could have asked, he asked that question, and who knows whether he would ever get a chance to ever ask a question of God again. And so one of the things I want to show you in Scripture is the Old and the New Testament combined have about 800 passages on wealth. It includes saving, spending, investing, tithing, running a business, running a family budget. Jesus speaks of wealth a lot as well. About 25% of the time he's teaching, he talks about money, wealth, possessions. And today we're going to talk about that a little bit. Here's a truthful statement. I think it's very true. The Bible treats wealth and possessions differently than our culture does. When we think of possessions, when we think of money, when you think of learning about finances, and the Bible just treats it absolutely different than our culture. When we look at our culture, the culture kind of tries to look for who to blame. The Bible's going to deal with our hearts, our spending, our motives behind our spending. That's where the Bible is going to focus its attention. Whereas in our culture, it tends to be less about personal accountability, more about shifting blame, isn't it? Rather than focusing on mistakes I've made, decisions I've made, heart, the reason behind things that are not godly about my spending, we tend to look for people to blame. One example that came to my mind is when we look at the culture and in economic down times, what happens is oftentimes we see the blame starting with the rich blaming the poor blaming the rich, particularly in a time of election season. We see a lot of this play out. The rich are mad at the poor for wanting free health care and benefits and those not willing to work, plus an unfair tax. While the poor will say the rich people, when it comes to the rip off the poor, the wages, the fraud, tax loopholes, greed. And we see this play out all the time. We see it play out that you should blame somebody else. The Bible's focus is looking at yourself, looking at your heart. When Jesus is talking, addressing finances and wealth, he's looking at your heart. Jesus in the Bible is concerned with your heart behind the matter. This man comes and he asks a good question, something a rabbi would often be a mediator for, right? Often pastors just like me, I deal with a lot of marriage counseling, a lot of issues in regards to that. It's not that the question was unusual. It's about whom you're asking and why this would be what you're focused on. And Jesus actually addresses his question, and he does it with a fearful heart. He warns him. So today I want to look at Luke 12, and I want to look at this parable, and I want to talk real practical. And the big thing I think we're going to talk about is coveting. It's a sin from the very beginning in the original Ten Commandments. Our hearts are prone to covet. And Jesus says this is a very serious sin. This is a very serious area of our lives. And I would say, listen, as Americans, we are, and I'll talk about this a lot more, we are the wealthiest of people that have possibly ever walked on this earth. And many of you look around and you think, no, not me, and I'm going to try to convince you, yeah, you are. I'm convinced everyone in this room is in the top 1% of the entire world in terms of the wealthiest people that walk the face of this earth. We are wealthy. So certainly when Jesus talks about possessions and coveting, church, it applies to us, your family. You, individually, this is a sermon that you seriously need to think about. Let's get into verse 13. We're going to read chapter 12, verse 13, all the way through 21, and we're going to get practical. Here's what it says. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance." We already read this. Verse 14. But he said to him, "Man, who made me the judge or arbiter over you?" Verse 15. And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentiful. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years.'" Notice his motivation. "Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, those will be. So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." I'd say two key verses. Verse 19, focusing on the soul. "You have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be married." And finally, the last verse. "So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." You can turn to the next page in your notes. What is covetousness? It's an original commandment all the way back from the beginning. This is not some new thing. This is something that God has said has been a problem in our hearts from the very beginning. It's been an area of struggle of mankind. This is way before the American dream. This is way before wealth. This is way before massive nations. People, God's people, people in general, have always struggled with covetousness. Here's what covetousness is. Covetousness is desiring what one does not have that another possesses. It is desiring what one does not have that it never possesses. Thus, it has not only a material dimension, but also inherently a relational dimension that damages our contacts with others. So practically, what does this look like practically? It is the loving of possessions. It's the resulting of hoarding possessions. Loving means, what does it mean to love possessions? You can't stop thinking about it. You can't live without possessions. It's always on your forefront. When you go to sleep at night, maybe many of you, your fights with your husbands, it has a lot to do, or with your wives, has a lot to do with finances, has a lot to do with possessions. who you pick to spend time with, who you pick to relationally to be around. Sometimes, oftentimes, when something as good is happening in someone's life, we get upset. Have you ever been around somebody that has a nicer car than you, has some job, or maybe is married to somebody, and in your heart you're actually unhappy as opposed to being happy for them? Happy for things they have, but rather in your heart you had this subtle inkling of anger or just wishing they didn't have that? That's coveting. That's coveting. Another thing I want to address is sometimes we don't even have money, yet we're still going to get it. What is that? That's evidence of coveting, and we call that debt. One of the things I wanted to point out to you is the average American home is somewhere around $5,700 in debt. Now, when I'm looking at this, I'm not looking at your houses or anything like that. I'm talking about credit card debt. Now, this is just averaging out those who are in debt, those who aren't in debt. The average person in our country is $5,000, $700 in credit card debt. That's serious. The average person in our country is in debt. Secondly, those who are in debt, here's the average for those who are in debt, not averaging those without debt and those with debt, just those who are in debt, when it looks at credit cards, they're usually around $15,000 in debt. So you tell me that coveting is not a serious problem in our country. We can't afford something, but we still have to have it. We still have to purchase it. Coveting is a massive problem in our country. It's evidenced by the amount of debt. Now, I want to point something else out to you. The other day, as I'm watching, I've kind of got to the point, I don't watch commercials. I don't enjoy watching commercials, because one of the things that happens in our country is we don't call coveting coveting, we call it advertising. We call it marketing. We call it PR. That's what we call advertising, but it's actually, guys, it's coveting. Most all commercials, what they're after is getting you to covet, for you to feel unsatisfied with the car you have, the job you have, the life you have. And because you see something and they look glamorous, what happens? You want it. You think you should have it. You deserve it. What we see advertising as is really producing coveting. The whole point of advertising is to get you to covet, to get you discontented, because you either have contentment or you don't have contentment and you have covetousness. So I encourage you, as you look at your life, as you think, as you watch ads, every time you're looking at an ad and you are not content with what you have because of an ad, or you see somebody glamorous or something and you wish you had that, guys, that is not just a good job by the commercial. It's actually sin. It's coveting. And what they're playing at is coveting. Most all commercials, that's what they do. That's their aim. That's how they go about it. Advertising exists to create in you a sense of discontentedness. Do you understand that? That's why when you're watching something or you're looking at something, all of a sudden you become very dissatisfied with the car you drive, the life you have, the home you live in. Advertising is massively producing covetousness. That's the goal. If it gets you to covet, you'll consume even when you don't have the finances to pay for it. That's important for us to think through. Americans often don't view this as a sin, but like I said to you, this is one of the original Ten Commandments. You can look at notes at the bottom of page 2. It says this, we're going to look at it, Exodus 20:17. Here's one of the original Ten Commandments. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Isn't that interesting? That has to be put in there. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his male servants, or his ox, or his donkeys, or anything that is your neighbor's. Guys, from the beginning, God has told man it is not healthy for you to look at somebody else's things and get discontented with the life God's given you. It's unhealthy. It doesn't produce godly relationships. Another form of the sin, Jesus brings it up. One of the issues I think Jesus is addressing when he's talking to this man is focused on wanting his possessions, and Jesus is warning him about the relationship problem. If he continues to go down this line of trying to get somebody else to intervene, to force the brother to give money, Jesus said what's more important is that relationship as opposed to the money. And I want to talk to you about a few things that I've seen. It happens every day in church life and families, and it just shows you greater how covetousness is a barrier in relationships. Materialism is barriers in our relationships. I've been in youth ministry for 10 years, and it was very, very often that I saw this take place, that there was a kid very discontented. So maybe there's one kid who has the nicest shoes, that has a cell phone at the age of 4, I don't know, something like that. That happens, it happens. And what happens is kids, more than us, than anyone, they see this, they see what they have, and they come home and they become angry. They become convinced. I don't know if you've ever seen this. A kid comes home convinced you've wronged them by not giving them what the other people have. Guys, in your kids, that is covetousness. And one of the things I want to say, and I want to say this often to us, we get caught in this world that we say, I need. Guys, we do not need. It's a want. When your kids come home and they're angry and there's division and tension in the family because your kid cannot stop asking about what they do not need, but they're convinced they need, your kid is coveting. When you play into that and you give them what you know in your heart, you said, we can't afford this. I don't think you're ready for this. This just because they have it doesn't mean you need to have it. When you play into that and you buy into that, guys, you're helping your kid become materialistic. You're helping your kid covet. It's coveting. And it happens. And I know that all of you, there's no person that has a kid that doesn't come home, comes in and doesn't say, I need this. I have to have this. But guys, I just want to warn you, if there's tension in your family because you're constantly purchasing things that your family can't afford or you don't feel like is the time for it, and your kid keeps complaining, guys, don't cater to their sin. It's coveting. And by the way, the same kids like you are watching the same commercials. You know how they do that in advertisement? They put the richest, most famous celebrity, and what do? They get on there and look at my life. James Harden, for example, I'm a Houston Rocket fan, has a $400 million contract with Adidas. What? He makes more money from Adidas than he does his own basketball career. That is crazy. Why? Because you know why? Young people see James Harden and they feel, I have to have those shoes. I don't know why. I mean, look at his beard. It's weird. he is odd looking. You know his chin is really messed up. Have you ever seen his chin? Never mind. Okay. He probably does need that beard. Maybe the first time I would say he needs that beard. I don't know. But that's why they use these artists. That's why they use these celebrities. It plays on coveting. And so that's one area that I've seen often, particularly in youth ministry. I saw many kids. It was very normal for me to see this as a fight in a family. And oftentimes what happens, and I don't want to step on more toes, but oftentimes a parent oftentimes wants to be a friend more than a parent. And so when that caters, when that coveting, when that anger starts raging, rather than loving and discipling, sometimes they give in and they play. And what you're doing is you're helping create a kid who realizes and thinks like a coveter. And what happens is the next trendy thing comes along and I need it. I have to have it. Rather than making good decisions, talking about making a budget, making decisions as the parents make the decisions, sometimes we give in. And that's important for you to realize that, again, your kids are watching the same advertisements. They're around the same amount of students. And there are some parents that don't call this coveting, and they give their kids whatever they want. And we are not called to be like the world. I challenge you with that. Secondly, I've seen this as a pastor. Some of the most dividing times in a family's life is when a person dies. So exactly what Jesus is addressing. I think Jesus is concerned. This man is talking about money, and Jesus is concerned about the relationship of this man and this brother. I've seen so many families never talk to each other ever again because somebody dies and they start fighting over the finances. Have you seen that? What is that? It's coveting. Guys, it's coveting. That's why you can have a whole family that's loved each other. Everything's great. A person dies. In the midst of a tragedy, people immediately are fighting over their wealth and their finances. And what do I get? And what I deserve? I should get this and they shouldn't get that. I see it all the time. Guys, it's coveting. It's coveting. What could turn a family hating one another, never want to talk to another again in the midst of a tragedy, a loved one dies? Coveting. What's most important on that family's heart? Money. It's a horrendous sin. Marriage. This is a hard one, but it's true. I listed a couple things in here, but I've seen oftentimes one spouse is hiding or lying about their spending. I walked into a house one day and walked into their home, and I saw a woman who had a spending habit. Every time she watched an infomercial, she had to buy it. And I remember coming in, and at one point she was very embarrassed because there were boxes everywhere, and you could tell this person was hiding all these things they'd purchased, didn't want their spouse to know, and it was kind of an odd thing for me to see. And then the reality is my mom's that way. And I realized it was one of the first times I had remembered this is a struggle that my mom had. And a lot of times there's a spouse spending money and lying about what they're spending money on. It happens all the time in marriages. Another time is maybe somebody works and somebody chooses to stay at home, and the spouse says, I make the paycheck, so I make the decisions of what we do with money. It's my money. It's not your money. It's my money. That happens all the times in marriage too. And guys, there's a materialism and a covetedness in which it's playing out in that scenario as well. Sometimes we may have both spouses, and I've probably never seen marriages fight over more than one of the biggest reasons marriages fight is money. Exactly what I unfortunately revealed earlier is our country is full of people in debt. And one of the things that happens is debt is like slavery. You don't pay $50 on certain debt, and what? Within 2 weeks, what's happening? You're getting a phone call from somebody trying to collect, right? And what happens whenever that one thing you owe and then it ends up being five other things that you owe, and now you're having six people, seven people calling you, debt collectors. The weight of that. Sometimes whole couples, even though they have debt, are struggling because of materialism, and both are struggling with covetousness. I don't know your life. I don't know what's going on. I don't know which one of these could be an inkling or part of a struggle, but this is a massive sin in our country, and we don't like to call it a sin. We don't like to hear about it. But Jesus' focus in this parable is really addressing the danger in relationships. He's addressing the danger in our hearts because of materialism and possessions. And so what do you do? What do you do? Well, Jesus gives us in verse 15 a couple things. He says, take care. Be on your guard. Basically, Jesus says, guard your heart. And I would say, guys, in a country that is wealthy like we are and has advertisement that is so clearly coveting all the time that we watch every day, we're just bombarded with this stuff. It is so important that you take serious Jesus' words. So say one of those scenarios stood out to you. Here's what I want to say to you is, what do you do to guard your heart? Well, here's an answer for you. You sincerely worship God. Covetousness and materialism, see covetousness and materialism for what they are. Listen, this is one of those sins I think people don't want to ever admit that they have a struggle with this. They don't want to admit that they struggle with materialism. But guys, the evidence of our country is people who are in debt, have no finances, still buy things that they can't afford. They buy a home that they can't afford. I told you guys this on a Wednesday night. I was counseling a couple whose marriage was on the brink of divorce, and the reason they were separated for years was because the wife continued to buy money, and the husband gave in and bought a house. And as I'm sitting with them, they're not married. They have marriage problems and struggles already. They've already been separated because of materialism. I hear them tell me the home they purchased, and as I was talking with them, and they had already told me the budget that they made and the money they had coming in, and I saw that they were buying a $350,000 home, and I sat there with, I don't even know what to say. They just built a home that they could not afford. They just came together after basically the marriage on the brinks, and they were separated for a long time because of materialism, and now they purchased a home that when I'm just doing the math of what they make, there was no way they could afford it. And it floored me. The sad part is they weren't Christians, and the sadder part was I knew there's no way that this marriage isn't going to enter into this home with tremendous tension because they're buying and purchasing things that they cannot afford. Why is that taking place? Coveting them. What do? You've got to see materialism. You've got to see coveting in your own heart. You've got to see that this is very likely, possibly, a sin in your family. It's very likely a sin in your own heart. That's what Jesus tries to do. Doesn't want you to blame or look at anybody else. Don't look at society. Don't look at your parents. Don't look at your spouse. Look at your own heart. Do you oftentimes think, I have to have this. I need this. The real truth is you don't. Oftentimes, coveting is in our own heart. Materialism is our own heart. But we don't want to call it a sin. It's a sin. And it's very dangerous. So the Ten Commandments say this. There is only one God. You are to worship God alone. And so here's one of the things I want to help you with is there's possibly idols at play. One of the reasons people struggle with covetousness and materialism is there's idols. But oftentimes it's not, sometimes materialism coveting is a surface idol. It's an idol, but it's not the serious idol. So I want to give you three possible idols that could possibly actually be the bigger issue than actually covetousness or materialism. Just three. Now, I could have given you so many more, but I didn't want to spend our whole time on idols. But one, sometimes there's an identity idol. And this is actually deeper than coveting. This is actually deeper than materialism. It's a person who feels that they have to have a certain car that they drive because it defines them. They have to live in a certain neighborhood because living in that neighborhood, it's part of their identity. It says something about them. They wear certain brands of clothes because it defines them. So the issue actually may not be the bigger issue, may not actually be coveting or just materialism. One of the bigger issues, maybe you find identity in stuff. And if you don't have this stuff, if you don't live in this home, if you don't drive this car, then you're not who you want to be. That may be the bigger idol that's really taken place. So the issue may not just be materialism or coveting. It might be you're finding identity as opposed to your identity in God, in Christ, and who he is. You're finding identity and worth through things. And that is a very dangerous place to be. That may be the bigger idol. For some people, I've seen this happen. The deep idol could be security. There are many people who are consumed with their thoughts about money and never give or spend it on anything because they don't trust God ultimately to care for them. And it's displayed in their huge attempts to stow and stash, and they never spend money on anything because ultimately they don't trust God. Ultimately, they don't trust that God is going to provide for them. So you know what they have to do? They have to have as much security as possible. There are many people that this looks like it's holy, this looks like it's righteous, this looks like it's godly, but at the end of the day, really, they don't trust God. They don't trust God, and so what happens is they are the opposite of the people that spend money out of control. They store, and they never give up money. They never spend money because they don't trust God, ultimately. They can't give. They can't be abundant in giving because what happens if I give and I don't have enough money? They don't give. That's another idol, and the issue may not be materialism, covenant. It may simply be security, not trusting God. You can't give because you have to trust and rely on your own ability to save. Another one is comfort. Comfort. For many people, why are you spending all this money? Well, you have so many hobbies or toys. Really, the bigger issue is comfort. It plays out with speaking so badly of needing comfort, needing ease, needing pleasure. You always need things that give you comfort, and so you have to spend money on things. Sometimes it's comfort. We want to have comfort. We need comfort, and so we get ourselves in a spending spree because you really enjoy a lot of things, and you feel like you have to have them. That's an idol. So, guys, what I want to say to you is I don't know. If you were to be honest today and you struggle partly with coveting or materialism, one of the things I want to encourage you, and I could do a much better job talking with you one-on-one, but there might possibly be a deeper idol as to why that plays into your issue. And so what does Jesus say? He says, guard your heart, worship God sincerely. Well, if you don't know the idol in your life, how can you rid your life of that idol? So what I'm saying to you is you need to explore honestly your heart. Are you struggle with coveting? Are you struggle with materialism? Is there maybe one of these stands out to you that you feel that one of the reasons for you is you have to have the nicest things and you feel defined by that? How would your friends view you if you had the cheaper jeans? That may be somebody in this room. And the deeper issue is status. For some of you, it's security. You don't give anything. You don't give to God's kingdom. You don't want to do that because you've got to keep and hoard all your money. That was this man, right? His goal was to relax, eat, drink, be merry, right? He had enough. And what did he do? He tore down his barns and grew bigger ones because he needed more space for all his junk. That's a sin. That's the one that Jesus calls out, the person that's doing that. And thirdly, a lot of people, it's comfort. You've constantly got to be satisfied, and you find satisfaction in pleasure and things and going on trips and doing all these things. You find your joy in those things. And guys, here's the danger. Things will never satisfy you. Things will never satisfy you. You don't know. Here's the problem with security. You don't know what God's throwing in your way. We have, at least right now, two people battling cancer. We have an amazing leader in our church that just lost their eldest son. You cannot ever plan security. That's the problem with someone who plans security, is you are not in control. God is. And ultimately, when you look at someone's deep saddle of identity, the problem is what happens is you're never going to be satisfied. You're never going to have enough stuff. You're never going to look good enough. You're never. And you know what? You're probably the person that stands in the mirror and you're more miserable. Even though you have all those things that you think would fulfill you, you probably aren't fulfilled. Why? Because you've placed your fulfillment and your identity in things, and it can't fulfill you. They're idols. They leave you dissatisfied. Does that make sense? Let's move on to the last page. Are you content? Here's the big question. Here's the big question, church. Are you content? If you're not content with the house you have, the things you have, the things God has blessed you, then you are in danger of coveting. You are in danger of materialism. What do you see in that child that comes and see this person has this bigger thing and this great thing and they come? Why? Some of those kids, I remember seeing this play out. Kids would come home and if I don't have this, then I'm not going to be liked at school. If I don't have this, then people aren't going to be my friend. And if I had this, then people would like me. You know, we do that too as adults. We just don't like it. We don't act like we do, but we do. Guys, are you content? If we're not content, we will covet. If we're not content, we will fall into the trap of materialism. We have to grow in our contentment. Philippians 4 is the famous passage. We're not going to read that together today. But here's what I want to say to you. If you have central heating, electricity, a toilet, a refrigerator, a car, a bed to sleep on, and by the way, I could have just said you have a car and you're one of these people, but I listed all these other things. You are seriously the wealthiest of 1%. It's important for you to fathom that. Because what happens ultimately, even as I'm talking, many of you are saying, hey, you're not talking about me. I'm not wealthy. Others are wealthy, and maybe this other person in this church is wealthy, but I'm not wealthy. I have to ground you back to the reality. You are one of the wealthiest people that walk the face of this earth. And not even just right now in this time period, of all time periods before you, before generations before us, we're the wealthiest of people that have ever walked this earth. If you have these things in your home or where you live, you are among the wealthiest people in the world. One of the things that stood out to me is I just moved here and I have a storage unit because we're living with a friend's home that has a fully furnished place, and so we had to put all our stuff in storages, and I didn't realize how significant this was, but one of the things that stood out to me is as I've been around the storage unit more and more is how many people have storage units for things that they don't need. They just don't have room in their home, so they throw them into storage units. I met several people that talked about the fact that they have one or two different storage units. They pay monthly fees for things they don't even want. Things they don't even need. They just store them in there because they don't have enough room. And it just keeps, you know, building and building and building. And it blew me away. And here's one of the realities. God has blessed me to get to go to Africa and India, and I've got to see the world. And here's something that stood out to me. Most storage facilities are about the same size as the average home around the world, made of about the same material, cinder block and tin. And they don't have a toilet. They don't have central heating or plumbing or oftentimes electricity. So here's the big point. So where we put the junk that we don't even want, that's where the average person puts their family. That stood out to me, guys. That stood out to me this week as I was praying about this, thinking about this. The reality is the majority of the people where they place their family is where we place the junk we don't even need. We don't even want. And we pay monthly dues just to keep up with it. I challenge you to look at your heart. I challenge you to look at how you spend your money. I challenge you to not say, well, this other person's rich and I'm not. Please don't believe that lie. You are wealthy. You are wealthy. It doesn't mean you are the wealthiest people in our society, but you are of the wealthiest people that walk the face of this earth. So every time you're not content, every time you're like, I don't have good enough stuff and I'm not happy and I wish I had more things, please try to go back to reality and remind yourself you are blessed. If you have air conditioning, if you have a toilet, if you have a bed, if you have a car, God has blessed you. Do not believe the lie that you have to have these things or you're not going to be satisfied. That's a road of content, of not being content. It's a road towards consumerism. I encourage you. Is it a sin to have money? No, not necessarily. Is it a sin to have nice stuff? Is it a sin to live in a decent home? No. Here's the issue for this guy. When you read through this parable, here's the problem. Look at how he speaks. He says, he, himself, I, me, he, I. He says, store my crops. I will tear down my barns. I'll store all my grain, all my goods. The problem is he viewed all his things as his. The Bible teaches that your things that God has given you are gifts from God, blessings from God, and God is going to judge us one day. What did we do with the resources he gave us? Now, some of us have abundant resources. Some of us don't. God has called you to be faithful with what God has given you. And like I said in the beginning of the sermon, oftentimes we get caught up in this idea that, well, if I had this, then I would do this. And I want to tell you this. Every generous person I've ever met did not become generous when they got wealthy. They were generous before they got wealthy. I want to repeat that. Every generous person I've ever met, spent time with, they didn't become generous once they got wealthy. They were generous the second because they saw it as obedience. And they were generous, and God may have blessed them, gave them more, or may have not. But people that are generous are generous before they get wealthy. Does that make sense? So I encourage you with a couple questions. Are we the center of our lives? Are all of your possessions for your consumption? Do you give towards God? Do you give towards this church? Do you give towards the poor? Are you generous with others? Jesus says this guy lived foolishly because what he did is he focused on himself. He focused what I see as his idol of comfort. He wanted to be in control, so he built bigger barns. He wanted to relax, eat, drink, and be merry. And what did God say? You're being foolish because you don't know when God's going to take you. I'll challenge you to make up in your mind, what would it be for you to give sacrificially and cheerfully? What would that be that God's called you to give sacrificially, to give cheerfully? What would it take? If you're thinking in your mind, well, I'm not going to give until I'm wealthy, you have the wrong heart. You give before God ever blesses you. You give because you want to be generous and faithful with what God has given you. You don't judge yourself next to the person next to you. You give what God's called you to give, of the wealth God's given you. That's what you're going to be accountable for. But it is a huge part. We give because we say to God, we're not going to be succumbed to the idols and possessions. There's much more to my life and my satisfaction than money. We give to God to be faithful. I encourage you, verse 21 is the final point. Here's what verse 21 says. So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. Church, we must be rich towards God. We must give to God. We must give to his kingdom. It's one of the ways you grow to be content. It's one of the ways you grow to be faithful. It's one of the ways you walk into this place and you feel you're a part of this church because you give. You give cheerfully. You don't give because out of a duty. You give because you want to give. You give sacrificially because you're choosing to give for the sake of God's kingdom. Not because you're forced to, not because some preacher told you to give. You do it because you want to. That's how God has called us to give. We could get into tithing and all these other conversations, but I just want to leave you with that. We are people that are consumed with materialism. Our culture is materialistic. It is very likely that if you go home and really seriously think about your kids, think about yourself, you probably at times struggle with covetousness. We all do. And I encourage you to really examine your heart. Is this an area of sin you or your family are struggling with? And I challenge you to ask God, what would it take for you to be rich towards God? What would it take for you to be a part of giving and not being controlled by your finances? I challenge you, if you're a person who's in debt, based on the statistics, there are many of you in debt. Many of you. And I don't mean home debt. I'm talking credit card debt. I challenge you to start thinking through the lens of, do I need this? Get this whole idea of need out. We know we don't need a lot of things. A lot of things are simply wants. You've got to begin to look at things and do I genuinely need this? The reason we don't have money to give, the reason we get caught up in possessions and all these things is we have not been able to understand the difference between want and need. There are many things we don't need, but we just want it. And sometimes it's coveting. Sometimes it's not, but sometimes it's coveting. If you are in debt because you keep buying things that you can't afford, you have to stop. Maybe you need to meet with someone else and talk about a budget. One of the greatest things your family could ever do is make a budget. Sit down with your spouse and make a budget and stick to it. When your kid comes up and says, I have to have this, you say, it's not within the budget. It's not in the budget. We can't do it. I challenge you, sit down. If you are in debt, if you have marriage problems because of debt, if you have that weight of debt, please sit down with somebody and talk. Develop a family budget. Live by a budget. Don't just go out and spend because you see an ad and you feel like you need it. That's how people get into debt. It's a big issue in our country, and I know that money is one of those topics people don't like talking about. But Jesus very clearly was worried about relationships. If you have the sin of coveting and materialism, listen, it will affect your marriage. It will affect your relationships. And guys, it's affecting your relationship with God. And Jesus, this man comes up, one question, any question he could ask, and he's trying to tell Jesus, give me money. And Jesus essentially looks at him and says, there's a much bigger issue at play is your relationships. And what's much bigger issue is your heart and the idols that happen when it comes to finances. And guys, we live in the most dangerous country in regards to covetousness and materialism. So this is a very serious issue for all of us in this room. So I challenge you, and we're going to go ahead and sing our last song. But whether you need to make a budget, whether you need to confess sin, whether you need to start thinking about what would it look like for me to be rich towards God, please be reminded that people do not become generous once they get rich. They're generous before they ever got wealth. Let me pray, and we're going to go into a time of worship. Father, I thank you for your word. I know that talking about money is always uncomfortable for many people. It's not particularly comfortable for the pastor either, but God, the issue is, it's the sin in our country, God. The debt that we have. God, many of us are struggling with materialism and covetousness, and God, we needed this word from you to be able to be honest about where we are. It would be no surprise to me that many marriages in this room are struggling because of debt, because of finances, because of fighting, and because of the stress that they're under right now because of finances. And God, you are a God of freedom. God, I pray that my sisters or brothers in this room that are stressed out over finances, God, I pray that you would let them find themselves in a place that they can begin to be freed from the sin of covetousness and materialism, that they would stop looking at other people's stuff and thinking they need it, but rather find their satisfaction in what you've already given them. We need to be satisfied with the many blessings you've given us. Remind us that we are actually among the wealthiest people that walk this earth. God, help us to not look at other people's and want their things and not look at other people and want to be them or look like them. Let us be content with who we are and who you've made us to be so that we can be filled not only with your presence, but know our identity is found in you. Thank you for your word. Thank you for this day. Thank you for this time. We love you. It's in your name we pray. Amen.